From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Gerald Reynolds is President Bush's controversial new pick to chair the United States Commission on Civil Rights. His appointment has been greeted with some cheers and some controversy. The 41-year-old African-American attorney has slammed affirmative action as a big lie, and many in the civil rights old guard are not happy to see him at the helm. But Gerald Reynolds says it's time to think again about civil rights. Tonight on Point, a conversation with the new chairman of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, Gerald Reynolds, and with you. But first tonight, we begin in Ohio, where 6 weeks after the presidential election, George Bush's victory is official, but still being challenged now in the courts. Recounts are underway in 9 of Ohio's 88 counties, with more to come. Mark Niket is a reporter for the Columbus Dispatch and has been covering the election aftermath. Mark Niket, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So you've got challenges on a number of fronts. Give us a rundown here. I mean, the Electoral College votes are in from Ohio, are they not?
Yes, Ohio's electors, like in other states, met yesterday to formally cast their votes for President Bush. But as you mentioned, there's an election contest been filed here in Ohio, essentially arguing that the result should be overturned based on what the people filing the complaints say is suspicions of fraud. And that's with our Ohio Supreme Court, and there's not been a ruling yet on that.
What sort of fraud and what sort of evidence are they bringing?
Well, they're mostly basing their complaints on exit polls, which in Ohio and other battleground states on election day showed that John Kerry was winning the state, and turns out he, of course, lost. Mm. And the suggestion is that these exit polls couldn't have been that wrong, that the sample that was used was done by a reputable firm and so forth, and that there must be some fraud involved to make these numbers come out so differently.
Republicans are calling those allegations silly, and President Bush is still there with his 119,000 vote official lead. Is there compelling evidence that's been brought forward, Mark?
Well, most of the folks who are sort of observing this from a nonpartisan perspective don't think the outcome is going to change either with this election contest or with the recounts, as you mentioned, are underway here in Ohio. The thought is that margin is just too large, that, you know, if the votes change a little bit here and there, it's not going to be enough to overcome Bush's victory.
And why are the recounts underway exactly?
Well, Ohio law allows any losing candidate to essentially pay for a recount, and here in Ohio, it wasn't the campaign of Senator Kerry that requested it, but rather the presidential candidates for the Green and Libertarian parties. They were willing to put up the money they raised over the Internet to pay for a recount in all 88 Ohio counties. So that's going forward.
Now, we also hear that Jesse Jackson has been in Ohio with a number of Ohio representatives complaining about systematic discrimination, he's saying, against minority voters in Ohio.
Yes, and there's been widespread complaints about problems on Election Day, particularly related to long lines at the polls and a suspicion on the part of Jesse Jackson and some other folks that urban and heavily minority precincts were left with too few voting machines, while voting machines were more plentiful in suburban or more Republican areas.
And again, is there good evidence for that? We all saw the photographs of long lines on Election Day. Is the sense in Ohio that there's a problem there?
Well, it's hard to say for sure. We studied that a little bit here in Franklin County, and it does show that there were fewer machines in heavily Democratic precincts than in heavily Republican precincts. But the response from the election officials is, one, if that's the case, it was unintentional, and two, the main problem was there just weren't enough machines to handle the crush of voters. There was a near-record turnout here in Ohio, and just not enough machines to go around.
Perhaps some planning in advance would have been good. I wonder on that front, Mark, if people are looking at these challenges as in any way approaches that might overturn the Ohio result, or is this largely about preparing for the next time, 4 years out?
Well, I think, again, a lot of the sort of the nonpartisan folks are thinking along those lines, that what we should be doing is trying to identify the problems and what can we fix so that we don't see these kind of problems again. You know, as far as the election contest is concerned, you know, most of the legal people I talk to think the bar is just very high. The legal standard is clear and convincing evidence that the vote total should be changed. And, you know, at least the people I've talked to don't think, you know, that's been shown in this filing so far.
Mark, thanks a lot for being with us tonight.
No problem.
Mark Niket, reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. He spoke with me from Columbus, Ohio. A watchdog muted was the headline in today's New York Times editorial about the changing of the guard at the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. The commission's 25-year member and longtime chair, Mary Frances Berry, is out. And a brand new member and chair, Gerald Reynolds, an African-American regulatory lawyer, has taken the helm. Not without controversy, Reynolds raised more than eyebrows when he said that he hadn't noticed that he'd ever personally experienced discrimination. In a 1997 article, he called affirmative action a corrupt system of preferences, set-asides, and quotas that discriminate in favor of certain groups at the expense of others. His appointment comes at a time when fewer than 50% of blacks own their own homes, and blacks are denied mortgages at twice the rate of whites, when schools in minority neighborhoods are badly underfunded, and the volume of black Americans going to prison is at an all-time high. But the new chair says it's time for a fresh look at civil rights. This hour, On Point Civil Rights Now, with Gerald Reynolds, the new chairman of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. You can join the conversation. Where do civil rights stand on your list of burning issues today? Are civil rights even on the national radar anymore? Are they on yours? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Kansas City, Missouri, is Gerald Reynolds, the newly appointed chair of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. Mr. Reynolds is an assistant general counsel for a Kansas City utility company. From 2002 to 2003, he was appointed by President Bush during a congressional recess to head the Office of Civil Rights at the Education Department. He has also worked at the Center for Equal Opportunity and as president of the Center for New Black Leadership. Good evening and welcome, Gerald Reynolds. Good to have you with us.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for joining us. And welcome to the roller derby. Here you come, you're appointed, and right away you've got this kind of kickback from some quarters, not all, cheers any number of quarters. But the old guard of the civil rights movement and today the New York Times going after you, your background and the attitude they perceive you bringing to civil rights oversight on the commission. Why do you think this kickback right from the start, Mr. Reynolds?
Well, change is always difficult. And there's been an orthodoxy in place for quite some time. And much of the principles embraced by traditional civil rights groups, I embrace. But in certain areas, I part company with the traditional civil rights groups. And I think that it's important to understand that civil rights has always evolved. At one point, the focal point was ending slavery. Another time, it was getting federal legislation to end lynching. And then at another point, it was to undo the racial caste system that existed in America. We need to look anew at the civil rights and ask ourselves, what are the insurmountable barriers that are facing disadvantaged Americans, especially racial minorities? And it's not to say that discrimination doesn't exist. I believe it existed yesterday, it exists today, and it'll exist tomorrow. And that's why we will always need vigorous enforcement of anti-discrimination laws. But I also want to talk about the racial gap in terms of academic performance. We need to do a better job of educating our children in urban and rural communities, especially racial minorities. I don't think that anybody is happy with the performance that we've had. We've had studies now going back decades showing the performance levels of many black and Hispanic students. And it's clear that we need to do a better job of educating these children.
But whereas traditionally what you call the traditional civil rights groups might have pointed to that and said, we've got a problem here in the way communities approach their schools, the way governments fund their schools. What I'm reading and hearing from you, Gerald Reynolds, is something, maybe, forgive me if this is too glib, but something more akin to the kind of Bill Cosby critique, which is, hey, folks, you've got to pull yourselves up by your socks. Is that where you're coming from?
Well, in part. I believe that we all have responsibilities. I think the government has a role The government provides education for most black and Hispanic students. I think that the government has a role has a responsibility to do a better job. I also believe that we need to start having conversations in our communities in terms of making sure that our children are prepared to receive an education when they go to school. I think that we need to look at attitudes. I've visited many schools while I was with the Department of Education, and it's amazing. There's peer pressure in certain black communities. In fact, there are some young black boys who feel that they will be ostracized if they master standard English, and if they're viewed as a geek, they feel that they will be ostracized. I think that we need to have conversations in our communities so that the community standards change, so that doing well in school is a good thing. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to get a sense, and we've got a lot to talk about here, and I really look forward to it, but I'd like to get a sense about you, Gerald Reynolds, and your background. Maybe just a simple question. Why did you want this job?
Well, I mean, my ancestors were slaves. My ancestors, and including some of my older relatives who were brought up in the South, they lived under a racial caste system. I've always had an interest in these issues, and despite the fact that I've had, despite the fact that, for example, that I'm a utility lawyer, that doesn't that hasn't dampened my interest. So, for me, it's just important. This is about the heart of the country. I mean, how we define ourselves as Americans. I think that in our attempt to define who we are as a people and who we want to be, we also have to make sure that we look at the folks in our communities who are the most disadvantaged and ask ourselves, how are we doing? Are we doing right by those people? And I think that, yes, we operate in an atmosphere where we have limited resources, but if we have to make a choice, I think that the disadvantaged folks who don't have all the luxuries in terms of wealth, in terms of access to wonderful libraries, I think that it's important that we ensure that they get a little more.
You grew up in New York City. Your father was a New York City policeman. You told a reporter that you're sure you're not sure that you'd ever personally experienced racial discrimination in your life. Did he get that right? The reporter that brought that across.
That was my response to the question was long.
Reporters.
It was a long response. Well, no, I mean, I don't think that reporter did anything wrong.
What is that your sense? Are you a child of the post Civil Rights Act era who really never suffered discrimination? Is that your sense
I'm not saying that I've never suffered discrimination. What I'm saying is that I live in a time, and I was brought up in a time where it. In polite society, you can't announce to the world, well, Mr. Reynolds, you're not going to get this benefit because you are black. If decisions were made, if adverse decisions were made against me, nobody was dumb enough to get up and wave a red flag and say, guess what, we're about to discriminate against you. So in that article, I said, I assume that that some people in my life have made decisions based on my race, but they did not announce it to me. So I hope that provides some context for that statement.
Okay, it's all fascinating to hear. Judd Reynolds, new chairman of the United States Commission on Civil Rights. Please stand by. We're going to take a short break here. Listeners, you can join us. Has America grown past the civil rights issues of the 60s, the 70s, or has it just moved on? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the new chairman of the United States Commission on Civil Rights, Gerald Reynolds, looking at the top civil rights issues in America today. You can join the conversation, where do civil rights stand on your list of burning issues now? And is it a problem that the new black chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission says he's not aware of ever having been the target of racial discrimination? Or is this something to celebrate? Are the old civil rights issues of race, of gender, of religion, history now or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Gerald Reynolds, I'm looking at a report here from a couple of weeks ago saying that civil rights enforcement in the first Bush administration, the first term, was sharply down. The volume of civil rights laws that had enforcement action by the government. What do you attribute that to? Are we just in a better time for civil rights, or is there a shift of focus away from civil rights law enforcement?
I believe that. I know in my particular case, I was at the Office for Civil Rights at the Department of Education, and there were some traditional civil rights groups who had a point of view in terms of what constituted racial discrimination. For example, some people, some groups argued that racial disparities is in and of itself evidence of racial discrimination.
Sort of prima facie, if the portions of racial groups achieving whatever are different, then there's discrimination.
Yeah, and that doesn't follow. Now, a racial disparity could be caused by discriminatory conduct, but there are other possible explanations for a statistical disparity. So. That's not how I investigate cases. I want evidence. I want to speak to witnesses. I mean, I don't want a mathematician who's just going to sit down and crunch some numbers and then conclude that somebody is guilty of discriminating against someone. I mean, that approach rests upon the assumption that that benefits will be distributed in proportion amongst the races.
So are you saying then that earlier administrations were enforcing civil rights law on a kind of formulaic basis, on numerical disparities, as you say? The Bush administration, what, got more real, looked under the covers, decided what was real and what was not here?
Well, I think that using statistical disparities as an investigative tool is important. And in fact, I did that myself. I used statistical disparities to target certain schools. There are certain schools that I believe may have been putting black and Hispanic students in special education programs in the absence of a learning disability. I believe that that students who have learning disabilities should participate in special ed programs if their parents decide that's the best for them. But in the absence of a learning disability, I don't think that that's proper, and race should not be the reason why they're placed in these programs. But I used statistical disparities, but not as a way to conclude innocence or guilt. It just pointed me in a direction in terms of my investigation.
You're 41 years old. You really are of a different generation from the leaders of the civil rights movement. You refer to the traditional civil rights groups, and you're bringing a new perspective, but I wish you'd clarify it for us a little more. Just in layman's terms, when you look at how what you call traditional civil rights groups have defined the problem, have looked at the problem of discrimination in the United States, whether it's racial or otherwise, and then you look at your own approach, what's the heart of the difference?
Well, I'm an empiricist. I don't. For me, there are no sacred cows. I mean, I look at a problem, gather the facts, perform the analysis, and I just follow it where it goes. There is no issue that is off limits. I think that if we're going to solve difficult, seemingly intractable problems, that we have to be empiricists. We can't rest on something that's akin to faith. We have to be willing to change our positions in light of changed circumstances. And if we're not willing to change in light of change, if we're not willing to modify our positions in light of you know, changing conditions. Mm. I think that we're not serving the people that we're trying to help.
So translate that into your interpretation of American reality 2004. Are you saying racial minorities are in different or much better circumstances now, and the traditional civil rights groups have not acknowledged that? Is that where you're going?
Well, I don't want to get into a dogfight with traditional civil rights groups.
Well, but there's evolution going on here. You represent it.
Yes,
and
yes.
So we just want to understand it.
Well, yes. I think that I can't. I mean, my life compared to my grandfather's or even my father's, the benefits that I have in 2004 couldn't have been imagined by my father or who grew up in the South or my grandparents. America has changed. There has been a sea change in racial attitudes in this country. I think that many Americans embrace the proposition that the government should not distribute benefits and burdens on the basis of race. Now, after saying that, I also believe that there are many Americans who believe that we have an obligation, if not a legal obligation, a moral obligation to help the disadvantaged. I think
this sounds more like compassion than like enforcing the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Well, no, I think that we need to have vigorous enforcement of our anti-discrimination statutes, and we have problems that we all read about in the paper.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I think that it's important that we do is find out what the government does well. There are some problems that I believe are not. The government is not suited to handle certain problems. And for example, in many urban communities, we have young black and Hispanic men who are all too willing to kill each other. Now, the government does a fairly adequate job of locking them up.
Mm.
But if we are concerned about getting to these young men early and preventing these killings, that I don't think the government can do much about that.
Terms of public safety, economic opportunity, infrastructure of communities.
Traditionally,
all these were seen as rungs of the ladder that were often missing in minority communities were led to that violence.
No, what I'm talking about, and
mm-hmm.
what I'm talking about is starting a conversation where we decide what we can do in the community, what the community can do, what members of the community can do in terms of solving problems that the government is just not able to tackle. In order to, I believe, prevent young black men from engaging in self-destructive behavior, I think that somebody from the community who knows that boy or that young man, someone who knows that young boy or that young man's family, has to step up and take an interest in that boy's life
and provide some
guidance.
Getting personal, not getting government involved. We're talking tonight with Gerald Reynolds. He is President Bush's new appointee as chairman of the United States Commission on Civil Rights. Gerald Reynolds, I want to begin to bring our callers into this conversation. They've been waiting patiently. We're at 1-800-423-8255, and KC is calling from Medway, Massachusetts. Hi, KC. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Just fine, KC. What's on your mind, my friend?
I just wanted to make a quick comment and referring to Mr. Reynolds not being aware of the fact that he's experienced discrimination. The first point I want to make is we have to be a little bit more perceptive, Mr. Reynolds. We've been afforded a great opportunity for an education. I work for an international company. I'm a vice president for that company. I'm an African-American. And even though no one's directly told me that there's been discrimination, I mean, I can recognize it just based upon the disparity between what's afforded to me and what's afforded to some of my colleagues. And I think that that's incumbent upon us to be aware of the fact that even though we've been fairly successful, we have to look out for those who are less fortunate, and they weren't given the opportunity that we were given.
Gerald Reynolds?
Well, I agree with the last part. I mean, I do believe that that we need to pay more attention to the disadvantaged. But I'm not talking about – I'm not trying to generalize my personal experience. In my case, I believe that I've gotten more than my colleagues. I think that I work harder. And I work weekends. I stay up late, and I expect to receive benefits commensurate, professional benefits commensurate with my hard work.
And discrimination hasn't been part of that picture. Even the kind of thing
that we hear from
middle class folks. I mean, driving while black. You know, the complaint that blacks get pulled over more often in any number of communities, driving down the street. Not your experience.
I've been pulled over before, and hate to admit it, but every time I was speeding.
I only raise it because black friends say, "Look, man, you have to realize this is a reality in my world."
But that's not to say that cops don't make decisions based on race. And in those instances where that occurs, I think that it should be stopped and the victim should be made whole. But, you know, we keep shifting from my personal experience. I'm not trying to say that my personal experience is every black man's experience.
Though it is the experience that you bring to the position.
I mean, it's sort of like saying that, Thomas Jefferson introduced some legislation in Virginia to ban slavery, despite the fact that he owned slaves. We're not limited by our personal experiences. Yes, they inform our views of the world. I know people who have been who suffered because of racial discrimination. My father's a retired New York City police officer, worked out of the 2-8 precinct there in Harlem, and I heard firsthand from my father about some of the discriminatory practices used by some of his fellow police officers. We need to sort of forget about Jerry Reynolds. This is not about Jerry Reynolds or Jerry Reynolds' experience. There is discrimination, and in my view, there will always be discrimination because humans are strange that way. Mm. And we need to, and that's why we need, we have to maintain our vigilance, and we have to vigorously enforce the anti-discrimination statute. I mean, there's no argument on that point. Mm. All I'm suggesting is that we have some other issues that we have to deal with and that we need to expand the conversation and we need to welcome a diversity of viewpoints when we have these conversations about civil rights.
Yep. Casey, thanks very much for your call. It is so interesting to see Gerald Reynolds trying to push this conversation forward. And I think many Americans are open to the idea of this civil rights conversation evolving, changing. On the other hand, a real sensitivity about jettisoning commitments along the way that are going to lead you to being grilled as you step into this chair. I want to bring one more voice into our conversation now, if I may. Joining us from Silver Spring, Maryland tonight is Ronald Walters. He's professor and director of the African American Leadership Institute in the Academy of Leadership at the University of Maryland, author of White Nationalism, Black Interests, Conservative Public Policy, and the Black Community. His forthcoming book is Freedom Is Not Enough, about the 40-year history of the Voting Rights Act. Ronald Walters, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Good to be with you.
You have, I'm sure, looked on with great interest as Gerald Reynolds has stepped into the chairmanship of the Civil Rights Commission, and I'm sure you've been following his comments and his reception. What do you make of the new kind of perspective that he's articulating here?
Well, it is not a new perspective. It's been part of the evolution of the conservative movement, which I call white nationalist movement, because it is has been managed by a relatively small cohesive group in the white community, and since the emergence of Ronald Reagan in the 1980s.
Wait, you're saying our guest Gerald Reynolds, African American man, is part of a white nationalist movement?
Yes, this movement was born as a reaction to the civil rights movement in the 1970s, gained steam when Ronald Reagan was brought into to office. And one of the things that he did was to appoint someone very much like Mr. Reynolds to be head of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, who really did not believe in civil rights. And so that what we have here really is a pattern going all the way back to the mid-1980s with Mr. Reynolds. He tried to do the same thing. So that the interpretation that he brings to the table of anti-civil rights as an agenda is a really very conservative interpretation of where America was going with respect to civil rights.
Gerald Reynolds may be conservative, but he certainly doesn't describe himself as anti-civil rights. He'll speak for himself, but just to get your response, I think you would say, let's push this conversation forward Is there no forward? Is this not what General Reynolds may be up to?
Well, what I heard was an attempt to try to change the direction of civil rights and to put the onus of it on communities. He has the job. It is not Minister of Civil Rights. It is not Sociologist of Civil Rights. It is the job of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission to assist the American government in enforcing the law, critiquing its behavior with respect to the way in which it administers the law.
Be the watchdog.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Mary Berry has done a fantastic job.
This is the outgoing chairwoman.
That's right. And I just assumed that you guys had talked about her, but in case you didn't, she has been equally hard on all of the presidents, both Democratic and Republican, with respect to their administration of civil rights. And so that is his job. It is not to sort of bring this discussion out of the government and sort of leave them alone. As a matter of fact, there are a number of questions about the extent to which Mr. Reynolds, who was a former official of this president, going into a job where he's going to be responsible for monitoring his behavior. To some people, that's a conflict of interest.
General Reynolds, how about it? Are you going to bring the teeth to this watchdog role? Are you too close to the White House? And what about the notion of you and others before you being related to a white nationalist agenda?
Well, I mean, I've been called many things, but a white nationalist is not amongst the epithets that have been hurled my way. Well, I disagree with Dr. Walters. His history. I mean, it seems to me that if I had to critique the position of Gerald Reynolds, I would say that it's a fusion between Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois. Mm. This is not my position. He is right that my position is not new. My position is grounded in black culture and in black history, and it goes back to the geez. I guess it's always been with black folks. You can, those who are familiar with the work of and the philosophy of Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois, you can tease out the strands of my views.
And you're talking self-reliance there.
It's a combination of self-reliance. At the end of the day, nobody's going to save you. You're going to have to save yourself. But at the same time, though, our government has obligations. And one of those obligations is to enforce the anti-discrimination laws. We have to do both.
General Reynolds, hold the thought there, if you would, please. And Ronald Walters, we've got to take a short break. We're going to come back and hear more from the new chairman of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and Ronald Walters from the University of Maryland. You can join this conversation as well. Have the civil rights battle lines moved? And where to? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the new chairman of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, Gerald Reynolds. Also with us tonight, Ronald Walters, professor and director of the African American Leadership Institute at the University of Maryland. You can join this conversation as well. Has America grown past the civil rights issues of the 60s, the 70s, or has it just moved on? What are you hearing tonight? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Gerald Reynolds, I wish you'd fill in the blanks a little bit.
Excuse me just a second.
Dr. Walters.
Let me respond to something, because I don't want the title of my book to be taken lightly, and it's not an epithet. I'm a political
scientist. This is white nationalism, you say.
That's right. Yeah. I'm a political scientist, and political scientists are comfortable describing nationalist movements all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's only in the United States that nationalism takes on a pejorative. The color coding of it is important, because this is not a movement that was fashioned by African Americans. In fact, it was opposed to a lot of what the civil rights movement stood for. So that in that sense, that responds to the color. There is a chapter in there on the behavior, the historical behavior of black conservatives. And black conservatives have always been at the service of radical white conservative movements. And so that they have shared a set of values
about. Who plays Booker T. Washington?
Just a second. They have shared a set of values about the role of African Americans in society.
But I think Gerald Reynolds' question deserves probably a reply there. Booker T. Washington, or he also cites W.B. Du Bois.
I was getting ready to say that this is not really a question of Booker T. Washington and W.B. Du Bois. He does not split the difference between those two.
Is Booker T. a white nationalist?
Nothing if not a very strong fighter against racism in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And he was someone who, in the 1930s and 1940s, was part of an elite group of leaders who really led that fight, who planned the strategy.
But is there no way that a black leader...
Just a second.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that he was one of the founders of the NAACP. So here you have an organization who was founded by A.W.B. Du Bois, who today can't not even get an audience with the President of the United States. So I wouldn't put myself, if I were Mr. Reynolds, in that legacy.
General Reynolds, this must be tough to take. This is
No, not at all. I mean, I think that it's important that we have these conversations. It's important that we have a diversity of views. Obviously, I disagree with much of what Dr. Walters says, but I think that this conversation is it's better to have the contrast. We have a comparison. We can compare and contrast the different approaches. And
but this isn't just an academic issue. He's saying you're essentially putting yourself at the service of white nationalism. He says he describes it as a political scientist,
the whole approach is interesting. I mean, it's an attempt to stifle dissent with a smoothed over ad hominem attack. I'm not a real black man, or if I am, I'm a lackey for the white man. Rather than to address my concerns on the merits, and instead of offering what I believe would be a thoughtful critique, what I've been hearing is basically an ad hominem attack.
What about the notion that a conservative black American cannot be an effective civil rights leader?
Well, it's crazy. The most conservative place in America is, on a Saturday, the most conservative place in America is in the black barbershop. When I go to my barbershop, I'm a lefty there. I mean, the notion that blacks aren't conservative that is belied by all the surveys that are done. The Joint Center for Economic and Political Studies produce wonderful, wonderful surveys showing the views of blacks on various issues, and it runs from moderate to conservative.
Well, I think, though, what you're really talking about is cultural conservatism. And certainly, I would agree with you that there are many blacks who are culturally conservative.
Mm.
It has a very deep strain in our community. We're one of the strongest churched communities mm-hmm. in America. Politically, however, it's different. The political conservatives in the black community you can put in a phone booth. And I think that really your emergence as a spokesperson and as a chairman of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission really is proof positive of what I'm saying, because political conservatism is such a small portion of the black community, and you have been elevated by white conservatives to that position. Mary Berry has been ousted. She has represented the dominant strain in the black community historically. She represents the mainstream.
She's represented the interest of people like you. She's represented the interest of traditional civil rights.
There
is a disconnect between the black community. When you look at the Joint Center's studies there, and you see that a plurality of blacks support school vouchers, and that the traditional civil rights group not only oppose vouchers, but they have ousted presidents of local chapters of civil rights groups when the local president has voiced support. And we can go down the list, whether it's school choice, whether it's vouchers. And in some surveys, a plurality of blacks have expressed deep reservations about the use of racial preferences. So
you didn't see the last study about the Joint Center that you
Yes, I did.
Okay, then what you saw then was for the first time a very significant dip in support for school vouchers.
Yes, you're right.
In
addition
to that, of course.
But wasn't there a plurality in favor of it? That's my recollection.
A slight plurality in favor of it. It's kind of like asking a respondent, do you want your kid to go to Harvard? Certainly, parents are going to say, yes, I want my kid to go to Harvard. So as far as I'm concerned, there's nothing surprising about that particular result.
Ronald Walters, Gerald Reynolds, I want to continue to get our callers in. So many that want to join the conversation with the two of you. Let me turn to Heather calling right now from Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, Heather. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to underscore, and I know Mr. Reynolds wants to talk a little bit more about not his personal experiences, but I think it's interesting that he would have the experience of not experiencing racial bias directly and overtly, because that colorblind orientation is sort of the old guard interest in integration.
No, I'm sorry, also, I didn't understand what you mean there, Heather, that colorblind.
At some point, the civil rights, especially in the realm of education, and I'm glad he brought that up, at some point the civil rights goal, at least legally, was to achieve integration so that we could all live in a colorblind society.
To get beyond discrimination.
Yeah, to get beyond it. I mean, but if you look at, you know, he talked about the racial test gap and racial achievement gaps. You know, we can't legislate that. We have to get at people's beliefs. What Americans today know is that it's no longer socially palatable to be overtly racist.
Right.
And I think that that more than anything shapes an experience where a successful black man, conservative or not, would not know or not have that experience.
So is it right that the Civil Rights Commission in 2004 should have just such a man as its helm? Does that mean that's where we've come to? And yes, indeed.
I think it's imperative that Mr. Reynolds lay out what he thinks the new civil rights are. I personally believe that, you know, education is a great arena for this. But we have to underscore how to get to the beliefs that propel racial discrimination, given that it's no longer okay to be overtly racist. How do we get at that? He said he was an empiricist. Then how are you going to find that out if people know that they can't make this an overt part of their action? If the statistics alone that consistently, regardless of class, that black students, you know, who have access to high-quality education still don't do as well as the white students, who's explaining that? I'm wondering about what tests, what kinds of tests he's going to use to find evidence of the belief systems that perpetuate the belief that racial minorities are inferior.
Let's turn to that, Heather. Thanks for your call. Gerald Reynolds, how about it?
Well, that last bit there, that racial minorities are inferior, threw me. Well, in terms of enforcing civil rights, that's not what the U.S. Civil Rights Commission that's not what the commission does.
You don't enforce, but you're supposed to be tugging on the pant leg of the government, going after them, prodding them to do it.
No, we're supposed to get our facts right. I mean, our goal is not to have someone in the office, being critical when there is no basis. I think that I'm going after quality here. I can get lots of accolades and praise by going after Bush. That's not my goal. My goal is to critique programs like No Child Left Behind, to discuss the strengths and weaknesses of No Child Left Behind, to offer thoughtful suggestions for improvement to No Child Left Behind. And that's just an example.
So does that mean that you don't want to be the watchdog, but rather a kind of advisory committee?
Watchdog. I want to get it right. Shaking my fist and criticizing just to criticize, that is not going to be my approach.
But presumably, no one wants you to criticize just to criticize. Presumably, everyone wants would desire that you act on the basis of facts.
Right. Well, that will be my approach. To the extent I offer criticism to any governmental agency, state, federal, or local, it will be based on the facts and the analysis.
Let's get one more call here. Laurel's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Laurel. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
As everybody knows, recently, you know, President Bush has created an atmosphere of exclusion for gay people by trying to disenfranchise this entire class of citizens through a constitutional amendment, barring them from marriage. And this is, you know, create an incredible atmosphere of discrimination. And, you know, to me it says the Equal Protection Clause isn't going to be applied to people outside of the racial definitions of civil rights. And I was wondering how Mr. Reynolds intends to proceed, you know, under this kind of an atmosphere.
On gay marriage and gay rights. Let us pick it up. And, Laurel, thanks for your call. Gerald Reynolds, turning the corner on race a little bit to the gay rights issue and gay marriage. Where do you stand on that? What will you push for or advise?
Well, on that particular issue, I don't have a position.
Do you see it falling within your purview as a civil right to be considered, supported?
I think that the commission, once we get together, we haven't had our first meeting yet. If we decide that that's an issue that we want to take on, that's what we will do.
How do you personally see it? Do you see gay marriage as a civil right?
I am a at bottom politically. I'm a libertarian. I believe.
Does that mean
that,
yes or no?
Well, I'm trying to answer your question.
Sorry.
Who you live, who you love, that's your business, basically. But if you're asking me whether gay marriages should be permissible. I think that that is a very complex question. It implicates an institution that it's thousands of years old, the institution of, maybe a thousand years old.
So it doesn't
old.
Sound like you'll be a champion of gay marriage in this position.
I'm giving you my views.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the institution of marriage is extremely important, and I have seen firsthand what happens when I look at the black community, when the institution of marriage is weakened. I've seen a whole lot of ills that flow from it, and I would be quite hesitant to tinker with the institution of marriage.
We've got the position. Ronald Walters, we've just got another minute or so here. Just in a few seconds, where do you see civil rights going in this next 4 years with Gerald Reynolds at the helm of this commission?
Well, I think I agree with many of the experts in the field of civil rights, particularly civil rights law, who say that given the political composition of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission right now, that the monitoring role of this commission is all but dead. I think you just heard that Mr. Reynolds is not going to hold this administration to task. Mary Berry, comparison, just said that in a 181-page report on civil rights in the Bush administration, was very critical of the administration's handling of civil rights, its lack of funding of civil rights agencies, its attempt to reinterpret civil rights.
Yeah, very critical on our way out the door. I want just time for one more comment. Gerald Reynolds, at the end of your tenure, whether it's 4 years, 8 or 12, do you expect to turn around people like Ronald Walters?
No. I would hope that traditional civil rights groups would listen and stop relying on their faith in terms of solving public policy problems.
And with that, I'm sorry, but we're out of time. It's been wonderful having you. Gerald Reynolds, new chairman of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, thank you very much for being with us tonight. And Ronald Walters, professor and director at the African American Leadership Institute, University of Maryland, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.